clearly the prevalence of material possessions in affluent countries places a grave responsibility on anyone who, unlike the rich young man, does want to follow Christ. We are too surrounded by the good things of this world. We are living in the most long-lived and most leisurely civilization in the annals of man. We are enveloped in so many facilities, so many conveniences, so many amenities, so many pain relievers, and energy savers. We have access to so much comfort and so much pleasure. We have at our fingertips the advantages of a cool breeze in summer and a regulated heat in winter. We have lotions for the skin and potions for the hair, and creams, and powders, and tints, and dyes. In the United States, our cats and dogs eat better food than millions of human beings in Asia and Africa. We consume more meat and more sugar and more alcohol, and we move more miles with more speed than was even thought possible at the turn of the century. Is it any wonder that our demographers write condescendingly about other nations as undeveloped because, by our standards, they enjoy less of this affluence than we? Let us not say that all of this is irrelevant to the spiritual life or unimportant in the pursuit of sanctity. Where affluence abounds, there the spirit of poverty must more abound. Otherwise, we shall be talking about holiness or reading the lives of the saints, but never grow in holiness or become saints ourselves. I maintain that while in every age money has been the root of all evil, as St. Paul so bluntly affirmed, the widespread affluence in certain modern cultures makes the widespread practice of poverty correspondingly necessary. Francis Bernardone became Francis of Assisi because, as the son of a rich cloth merchant, he gave up all his possessions to follow Christ. He became a Franciscan, to coin a phrase, because he had first been a wealthy person. He had positions to give up to make the sacrifice even possible. We need this example today to shake us out of our lethargy. Not unlike Francis, we too have more things that we can sacrifice than I think we are ready to admit. He had His grace, and we have ours. But unless we too learn to share what we have in such abundance, or sacrifice, because it weakens our devotion to Christ, or do without, because we wish to embrace His cross, the lesson of our affluent age will be lost on us. The first prominent feature of contemporary spirituality, therefore, is and must be the spirit of poverty. This means a sincere detachment from those myriad pleasant things that our affluent culture provides. It need not mean that we become actually poor, speaking in general, unless that is, as it is, our vocation in life. Religious cannot be satisfied with the spirit of poverty. They must be actually poor. It means then that we know the kind of age we are living in and the duty we have not to conform to the world which is trying to seduce us. So much for affluence and its correlative poverty. Social mindedness. If ours is the age of accumulating prosperity, it is also the age of social mindedness. This seems to be the best single term to describe, without defining, a host of qualities that enter and center around the social nature of man. Human beings are at once individuals and members of society, and no period of history ignores either side of our nature. But modern man is particularly concerned with the social dimension of his existence. To a degree never before evident, perhaps because he had never had such possibilities. Do you know that practically all the social sciences have come into existence within the last 100 years? Some would trace this social consciousness to a reaction against the rugged individualism ushered in by the Industrial Revolution. Certainly, Marxism changed its name and became communism. Hear that? As a violent reaction to the real and apparent abuses of capitalism, and the movement towards a collectivist society is at least partly explained by the greed in individuals, in government, finance, and industry, which the collectivists claim they can restrain. Others would say that our social awareness is a response to the universal cry for peace among nations that have suffered the agony of two world wars and dread the possibility of a third, this time nuclear, conflagration. Either we somehow get together and settle our differences amicably, or we shall destroy one another, and the Armageddon will soon dawn. On these premises, the option is either togetherness and survival, or hostility and global annihilation. No doubt, these factors have contributed to the situation, but I do not think they are primary to explain why our modern world is so preoccupied with man as a social being. The main reason, I believe, has been the development of communication through every possible kinds of media. The telephone and telegraph, radio and television, radar and computer, photography and film and their derivatives, and the rapid communication between peoples in a country and between nations. Lest we suppose all of this is too secular to intrude into a discussion of the spiritual life, we should read what Pope Paul VI said through his Pontifical Commission for the Means of Social Communication, a passage, two paragraphs, needs to be seen in full. Let me quote. The channels of social communication, even though they are addressed to individuals, reach and affect the whole of society. They inform a vast public about what goes on in the world and about contemporary attitudes, and they do it swiftly. This exactly coincides with a Christian conception of how men should live together. These practical advances have the high purpose of bringing men closer with one another. By passing on knowledge of their common hopes and fears, they help men to resolve them. A Christian estimate of this contribution that the media make to the well-being of mankind is rooted in this fundamental principle. Unquote. The Papal Commission. It would be a mistake, then, to underestimate social communications as an index of contemporary spirituality. This spirituality, even at its most interior and contemplative, is to be aware of others to an extent and with a depth of compassion for their needs that until our day could not have been had. What would St. Paul, who wrote about his solicitude for all the churches, say about the solicitude that Christ's followers should have? about others nowadays when we are daily and all day made conscious of the trials and tragedies of people all over the globe. What a catalyst for the practice of charity. What would St. Paul, who traveled incessantly to preach Christ in his day, do today? How I comfort myself with this thought. If he had at his disposal, as we have at ours, the means of affecting not one or a dozen or even just 1,000 souls, but literally whole nations with a word of the gospel and the example of a holy life. No one is minimizing the primary importance of union with God through prayer and of mastery of our passions through self-denial. The spiritual life must have deep roots if its branches are to spread wide, or to change the figure, it must have a source in the wellsprings of divine grace, if it is not to run dry in the active apostolate. But given the roots and the resources, it must today also have scope and breadth and vision. They are the opposite of narrow-mindedness or small-mindedness. In the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, Christ is made to say, "It is my will to conquer the whole world and all my enemies, and thus to enter into the glory of my Father. Whoever wishes to come with me must labor with me, so that following me in suffering, he may also follow me in glory." This call of Christ the King was made in equivalent words 1900 years ago. It is our privilege to put his call into extraordinary effect in our socially conscious and interrelated world today. Concretely, this can mean many things. It will enlarge our hearts to see beyond the immediate work we are doing to the teeming millions redeemed by the same blood of Christ. Unlike in former days, the people of Asia and Africa are no longer far away, because distance is no longer measured in miles, but in the time it takes to reach a given place. With hearts thus spiritually enlarged, we shall expand the scope of our prayers to include not only a few but many souls, and pray that God's grace, which is infinite, will share its plenitude with the whole of mankind. As our horizon broadens, we shall instinctively ask ourselves, what is the greater glory that I can give to God in whatever I am doing? How can I affect not only the small circle of persons with whom I come into immediate contact, but beyond my immediate environment, thousands of others who except for what I have done would know God less, or love Him less, or serve Him with less generosity. I admit that talking in these accents may seem strange to some people and positively unintelligible to others. No matter. The principle at stake is so great, and the prospects of influence in today's socially connected world so good, that I will be satisfied if only a few appreciate what I am saying. Come to think of it, Christ's vision of the future was always in cosmic terms. He bade his disciples preach the gospel to every creature. He told them to be his witnesses even to the ends of the earth. And in the Apocalypse of St. John, he gave a dramatic prediction of the worldwide struggle for mastery between his own followers and the agents of the evil spirits. If these global proportions are breathtaking, they're supposed to be. We have today the privilege and opportunity to expand our spirituality and motivate our apostolic zeal with Christ to the ends of the earth, or in St. Paul's words, to bring all nations to the obedience of faith in honor of Christ's name. Thank you for your patient listening.